about an extremely high level here. So asakti, the word, like ruchi means taste, asakti means attachment. On the basis of the taste, which has arisen because of being so fixed, on the basis of the taste, the devotee is extremely attached to devotional activities and always being engaged in devotional activities. So after this, when the taste, when the ruchi for the activities of devotional service reaches extreme depth, and Krishna becomes the very object of one's devotional activities. What does that mean? Anyway, we'll come to that in a minute. One attains a sakti. So the kripa, we mentioned the kripa of bhakti yesterday, the seed in Shraddha, and it gradually grows like that. So at this point, the kripa is bearing buds. So, oh, it mentions here. The buds become flowers in bhava and fruits on the level of prema. Very nice example. Very nice. So now there is a difference between ruchi and asakti. On the level of ruchi, obviously the devotee is attached. The devotee hears some kirtan and the devotee's mind just becomes absorbed and the devotee just loses sight of whether it's day or night or here or there or anything. Simply absorbed. So the devotee is certainly attached to Krishna and devotional service. But there is a difference. There's a difference in degree of attachment, and there's a reason for the difference of degree. And the essence of that is that Krishna is becoming the very object of one's devotional activities. So, let's just read what he says and hopefully it'll be clear. The difference between ruchi and asakti is this. Ruchi has bhajan, or your devotional activities, as the subject, and asakti has the Lord, who is the object of bhajan, as the subject. So what that means... Anyway, I'll just read on another few sentences. The stage can be decided from the amount of each component. Actually, ruchi and asakti have both components. But by the intensity of one or the other, ruchi and asakti can be distinguished from each other. And the essence, in a sense, is now in the next sentence. Asakti polishes the mirror of the heart to such a condition that the Lord, reflection of the Lord, or the Lord, reflection means the Lord, suddenly seems to be visible there. So now, ruchi has bhajan as the subject, but asakti has the Lord as the subject. So this means that on the level of ruchi, the devotee is relishing the hearing and chanting, the serving, the associating, and all these things. The devotee is relishing the devotional activity. Now, why is the devotee relishing? Like when you chant Hare Krishna. Everyone chant?
Hare Krishna!
Okay, very good. We should do it more often. So, now what are we relishing? If we are relishing. Hopefully we're relishing. Or what are we doing? What are we tasting? Krishna. Why is it nice to chant Hare Krishna? Because Krishna is there. It's not just an energy. There's some energy there, and when you feel the energy, it feels good. No. Krishna is there. So when you chant Hare Krishna, Krishna's dancing on your tongue, and you taste Krishna. And Krishna tastes very nice. Now, depending on whether your tongue is diseased or not, as we were discussing, the taste will differ. If your tongue is still diseased, then you'll taste Krishna. When you chant Hare Krishna, you're tasting Krishna. But because your tongue is diseased, then you think, oh, bitter. Bitter. But then you're chanting on and on, becoming purified, cleansed of the disease, on and on. So then it becomes okay. I can chant Krishna, yes, all right. Krishna, Hare Krishna, it's all right. And then you go on, you're in ruchi, and you're chanting. You're absorbed like that. Your tongue is now contacting Krishna, as it has been in the other stages also. But your tongue is now a little purified, so you're now tasting a sweetness. Oh, chanting Hare Krishna, so nice. So what is that? You're actually tasting Krishna as he is, because your tongue is now capable, or becoming capable of tasting the real taste in the real way, rather than the bitter way because of the disease. So, ruchi means that you're getting so much taste from tasting Krishna, actually. And, just like you know the story, I've mentioned this many times, there's the picture of Krishna, little baby Krishna lying on the, I think, peepal tree leaf or some leaf or other, right? Sucking his tongue. Banyan, well, they're all banyan trees. So, someone asked Krishna, why are you sucking your tongue? I'm sure you've heard this before. Krishna said, well, my devotees keep talking about how sweet my lotus feet are. So I wanted to find out for myself. So I'm sucking my toe, and I can see that my toes are very sweet. So then he immediately put his toe back in his mouth and continued sucking. So actually Krishna tastes sweet, actually. If you were to lick Krishna's body, as long as your tongue doesn't have the disease, material contamination, you will taste such a taste, literally, taste with your tongue. You will taste such a taste, you'll think, wow, this is astonishing. This is also why Bakasura, you know Bakasura, tried to swallow Krishna, but he couldn't, he spat him out, because he had the disease. So Krishna tasted foul. So he just spat him out. Oh, what a taste. He was actually tasting Krishna's body. In fact, so when you chant, your tongue is contacting Krishna's body. And depending on the degree of the disease you have, you will taste Krishna's body differently. And on the level of ruchi, you will taste it to be so nice that you'll just want to go on and on, and you'll become oblivious to everything else. So therefore, ruchi has bhajan as the subject. Bhajan meaning activities in which you are contacting Krishna and experiencing the taste of Krishna in different ways. In the prasad, in the discussion, in the kirtan, in the association, in the pictures, in the books, in everything like that. But now asakti has Krishna as the subject. So what does this mean? Well, it's inferred here on page 21. Am I right? Yes. That asakti polishes the mirror of the heart to such a condition that the reflection of the Lord, which is not such a brilliant translation, other translations are better, they make it clear that the fact is that the devotee is actually perceiving Krishna. The devotee is not just a taste, that because Krishna is there, I'm tasting Krishna, even though I don't see him, but because he's there, I taste something sweet. But the devotee is actually perceiving the cause of the sweet taste, which is Krishna, directly. So, asakti means that the devotee is getting there's a sense of the actual presence of Krishna, which is not hallucination, not mental concoction, but the devotee is actually beginning to perceive Krishna as being present and is extremely attached to that. So you follow the idea? Very interesting. And on an extremely high level. So then he goes on that the rest of this page 21 is basically the same thing which appeared in that last paragraph about ruchi, expressing the mind of such a person, but now he's expressing it in great detail, because the state of mind of the devotee on asakti is very extraordinary. All sorts of things are there. One very interesting thing, if you look in the second to last paragraph, sometimes wandering in the forest, absorbed in emotion, observing the movements of the animals and birds, he will intuitively interpret them as signs of mercy or punishment of Krishna upon himself. Because he's beginning to perceive Krishna actually being present, then he'll be looking, where is Krishna? Is Krishna here? Is Krishna there? Is Krishna doing this? Something is happening. Is Krishna doing this? Is my Lord's hand actually here? So if an animal, he says, if Krishna is showing his mercy to me, then the antelope in the distance will come towards me 3 or 4 steps. He's looking to see. And he's interpreting in that way. It may be true or maybe not. I mean, whether the antelope comes, whether that is an indication from Krishna or not, it may or may not be. But he's seeing it like that because he has this intense attachment which is just driving him towards Krishna. If he is not showing mercy, if Krishna is not showing mercy, the antelope will turn away. So he's looking, where is Krishna? Where is Krishna's hand? And where is he even in person? On the outskirts of a village, seeing a small Brahmin boy playing, reminding him of Sanaka Kumar, he'll inquire from him, will I see Vrajendra Kumar today? Will I see Krishna today? Now this, of course, could be any little boy. He just happens to be playing there. And now this devotee in this rather extraordinary state of mind is asking him some question which this boy never thought about. How does he know whether the devotee is going to see Krishna or not? So the boy may say anything. But the boy says no. The boy says no. So the devotee thinks, wow. Wow, what is this? This is a sign from Krishna. So in other words, it's sort of reminiscent of it's an otherworldly state of mind. And so therefore, people may interpret this state of mind in negative ways. He's becoming so absorbed, like we said on the level of Ruchi, so absorbed that the world doesn't exist any longer. He's just absorbed in hearing and chanting. Doesn't matter if it's day or night or whatever's going on, he's just absorbed. But here now he's so absorbed, so much more absorbed, that it's like losing touch with reality, or so-called reality. So he goes on to say, let's see, the next last paragraph. When asked by his relatives what is the matter, he'll sometimes act like a mute. But at other times, he'll act as if he's normal. His friends will apologize for him. Don't worry. Recently, he became a little scatterbrained. His neighbors will conclude that he's an idiot. The followers of Mimamsa, meaning like rigid Vedic philosophers, something like that, will think he's a fool. Those who study Vedanta, the spiritual philosophers, will think he's an illusion. He should be analyzing philosophy about the absolute truth. But he's wandering around asking people if he's going to see Krishna today. So they'll think he's an illusion. The Karmis, those who are practicing material piety, will think that he's on the wrong path. But the devotees will say he's attained the highest truth. Actually, he hasn't. There's still some stages to go, but practically speaking, he's attained the highest truth. So like this, the devotee, oblivious of respect or disrespect, having fallen into the current of the great celestial river of attachment to the Lord, will simply continue in the same manner. Now, of course, Prabhupada, who was on a higher level, didn't act like that. Sometimes he would a little bit, although you'd hardly notice, you'd have to look, and sometimes you might perceive that Prabhupada was sort of drifting off, drifting away from so-called reality. So one point to bear in mind is that if a devotee who otherwise you might expect to be very advanced, but if they're not manifesting these rather like materially abnormal symptoms, then it doesn't mean that they're not on the level of a sati or bhava or whatever level it may be. The thing is that the Uttama Adhikari, who is acting as a preacher, by the order of Rupa Goswami, has to act as an ordinary person. So even though sometimes it may be very difficult, still he'll try to act as an ordinary person. So Prabhupada generally acted as an ordinary person, in the sense that he was very down to earth, very clear-headed, and he was very organized like that. So that doesn't mean that he wasn't on this level, internally. So a devotee may be functioning on this level internally, but externally, because the devotee is acting as a preacher and is under order like this, then they may act as the most, as a very together person. So people would not think that he's on this very high and very emotional level of attachment for Krishna. So, in other words, it doesn't have to be as open and obvious as this, necessarily. Although this is like the essence of it, internally. Comments or questions? I know we're all getting onto levels which may be a little hard to relate to. And I hope, you know, we're making it clear enough. Someone wants to ask someone? Which? Bharat Maharaj. No. He was on the level of Bhava. Yes. But he fell down. Because of his offenses in the past. Now, in everyone on the level of Bhava, we understand that there'll be some effects of their offenses from the past. But if you haven't committed very severe offenses in the past, then the effects of them on the level of Bhava will not be very disturbing. But if you committed some bad offenses in the past, very bad, then it is possible that the effects may really disturb your devotional service, even on the level of Bhava. So, I mean, we all know, we hear it so many times, and we'll say it again. We should be very, very careful of offenses. Yeah. Very, very careful. Because you may get over the immediate implications quickly. You may sort it out with the person, and the person says, okay, don't worry about it. So in a sense, it's done. But the after effects can linger on. They tend to linger on. Yeah. Okay, just don't drift off yet. That's a good question. How do you protect yourself from the tendency to commit offences? Well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur makes a very nice suggestion. How to protect yourself from offending in Harinam Chintamani. He says that there are two things you can do. One is, you can just think that I mustn't commit offences, and just be, you know, thinking regularly like that. I mustn't. Am I? You know, I must not. Like that. Being very attentive to not commit offences. Then he says there's another thing you can do which is even better. That instead of just thinking that I must not commit offence, I must not blaspheme this divinity, I must not disobey the order of my spiritual master. He says that you can positively do the opposite. Meaning, you can glorify the devotees. Whenever you meet a devotee, you glorify them. So automatically you're doing the opposite. You're automatically not blaspheming, but you're actually doing the positive. And you can be very anxious to know, what are the orders of my spiritual master? What can I do for him? Like this. So he recommends that you try and do the opposite, practically, rather than just try and come to like a zero point, that I'm not doing the offences. It's like a neutral point. But go on the positive side. Instead of thinking that I mustn't blaspheme the Vedic scriptures, think I must have a deep interest in understanding and following the Vedic scriptures, and studying them and appreciating them, like that. So he says that this is a better way. You'll automatically avoid doing the offence. And actually you'll be doing a very positive thing. So that's a suggestion from Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Some other comments or questions? Okay. Srila Prabhupada. Becomes free of unwanted things, at least to a very great extent. So the bad habits, the attractions to material things, misunderstandings, wrong conceptions about what is the process of devotional service, all these things essentially are eliminated. So when they're eliminated to that extent, then naturally the devotee is very easily able to be very absorbed in devotional service all the time, always chanting without impediment from the mind, always attracted to engaging in devotional activities, always attracted to Krishna Katha, and no real attraction to anything else. So naturally on such a level of devotional service, the devotee is very blissful, and the devotee is fixed in Krishna consciousness. So this is a very nice level, actually. Problems are gone. Essentially, problems are gone. None of us, of course, enjoy problems. And to some extent, I'm sure we've taken to Krishna consciousness, at least with some idea that it'll help me to get out of my problems. That is a common motivation, at least one type of common motivation for people to take up Krishna consciousness. So we should understand that the way to get to that point where we're always happy, very, very happy, and there are really no problems of any great significance, that is to come to this point of being steady in Krishna consciousness, free from anarthas. So the devotee then who's so absorbed, always engaged in devotional activities, with the mind, generally at least, always remembering Krishna, then because Krishna consciousness is so sweet, it's blissful, being transcendental. By nature, Krishna consciousness is blissful. So when the devotee is always fixed in Krishna consciousness, the devotee is always blissful. And the devotee is tasting a very wonderful taste of pleasure in all these devotional activities. Then the devotee, being absorbed in devotional service, with this taste becoming more and more absorbed, then the devotee becomes more and more attached to Krishna. We were making the point yesterday that the devotee on that level is, on the level of asakti now, is beginning to perceive Krishna. Whereas on the level of ruchi, the devotee is enjoying the devotional activity so much. This is ruchi, that enjoyment of the devotional activities. What is that enjoyment? That is the contact of the senses and the mind with Krishna. But on the level of ruchi, the fact that one's senses and mind are actually contacting Krishna in person is not so apparent. But on the level of asakti, one begins to see Krishna, actually. In this way, he was making the distinction between ruchi and asakti, that in ruchi, bhajan is the subject, or devotional activities. And in asakti, Krishna, who is the subject of the bhajan, or object or whatever. Object, is it? Okay. Krishna himself becomes the subject. Within the bhajan, it's just like a deeper perception of what is the bhajan, or what are the devotional activities. There was one particularly interesting point that I unfortunately skipped over yesterday. Where is it? It's in chapter 6, and all I have to do is find it. Anyway, the basic point is that It's about how he withdraws, how his mind becomes withdrawn from material things. Yes. Where am I? Of course I don't have it, do I? That's wonderful. Anyway. Yeah, I don't have page 21. Or maybe I do. 11, 12, 17. Okay, anyway, you get the idea. It's there. Thanks. Page 21. Right, second paragraph. So, in the stage previous to Asakti, the devotee, on realizing his mind has been overpowered by material objects and desires, by his deliberate effort, almost withdraws his mind and almost fixes it. Anyway, I don't know if that's a correct translation, but the devotee definitely, by deliberate effort, withdraws the mind and fixes it on Krishna, actually. But at the appearance of Asakti, absorption of the mind in the Lord is automatic. Without having to make an effort, it happens without effort. A devotee at the stage of Nishta cannot detect how and when his mind withdraws from topics of the Lord's qualities, forms, etc., and fixes itself on material affairs. So, we don't want to give a contradictory picture of what Nishta is. On the level of Nishta, definitely the devotee is basically fixed. But there are some contaminations still there. Generally, they're not an obstacle. But because they're there, sometimes they are. But it's not like on the level of Anatha Nivritti, where practically step by step one has been confronted with problems. So sometimes on the level of Nishta even, because there are existing some contaminations still. So sometimes the devotee's mind withdraws from Krishna consciousness, and the devotee finds that, oh, now I'm thinking of something material. And then by some deliberate effort, he has to make the effort to withdraw the mind and bring it back to Krishna. So he can do it, actually. On the level of Anatha Nivritti, a devotee, a person, may go for days meditating on sense gratification and thinking, well, I shouldn't, but, you know, and then the mind goes back to sense gratification. Then half an hour later, the devotee may think, well, you know, I really shouldn't be doing this, should I? But then the mind goes back. So it may go on, it may be quite a thing. On the level of Nishta, is really not happening very much. Essentially, the devotee is fixed, but because some contamination is there, sometimes some material attachment may arise. On the level of Ruchi, actually the idea is that the devotee can quite easily withdraw the mind. And the idea is regarding Asakti, that the devotee doesn't even have to make an effort to withdraw the mind. If somehow one is exposed to some material thing, and the mind being like a machine, basically, doesn't really have much discrimination. If it perceives something, it thinks about it. And then our intelligence may say, no, don't think about it. So if the mind perceives something, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that the mind of the yogi is like an ocean, that things flow into the ocean, but they have no effect. Rivers flow into the ocean, but they don't affect the ocean. So in this way, things may flow into the yogi's mind, but they don't stay there. They just flow on out. So it's not that the devotee is not aware that there is a world around. So the devotee may see things and they make an impression. Now on lower levels, when those things make the impression, the mind gets attached. Oh yes, what about that? Sense gratification. On the level of Asakti, the impression may be there. One is exposed to some material influence. So some impression is there. But the mind immediately just goes back to Krishna. You get the idea? Thank you. Thank you. So, Asakti. Asakti is a very high level of pure devotional service. and the devotee is developing what something which you could call from the material point of view something like an obsession with Krishna. Something like that. It's like an unrelenting interest in Krishna, Krishna's service, chanting Krishna's name. Like and he's looking around, considering where is Krishna here or there? Something is happening, and he thinks, oh, is this a message from Krishna? And actually, he will be getting messages from Krishna. And what to speak on the level of a sakti, even on lower levels, the devotees also, they do get that. But he being, you could say, obsessed with this idea of Krishna's personal presence as a not quite tangible, but sometimes tangible, like a haunting presence of Krishna, then he may think, the example was that, oh, there's some antelope over there. If they move a few steps towards me, then Krishna is telling me this. Or he goes up and asks some boy, some ordinary boy walking here and wherever we are in Phoenix, will I see Krishna today? Boy, what? I beg your pardon. Yes. Oh, really? So, in this way he becomes captivated. So this is really very high level of consciousness of Krishna. And because Krishna consciousness is not of this world, and this world is not a very nice place to be of, so he starts to sort of lose contact with this world. Major. So then, let us go on now. Chapter 7, page 22. These are descriptions of such high levels of Krishna consciousness that it's very hard for us to really explain them, and it's very hard for us to understand them, other than certain features which are particularly prominent. So I won't try to so-called explain so much. We will rather read some of these descriptions, and I'll say a few words here and there. So when asakti achieves extreme maturity, it is called rati or bhava. The actual translation of this word, bhava.
Bhava equals ecstasy. And rati, for that matter, is almost synonymous.
But it's not quite.
It actually means attachment.
Like Sri Guru Charane Rati. Attachment for his lotus feet is the perfection that fulfills all desires. You know that song. Sri Guru Charane Padma. So rati is sort of synonymous, but not exactly. Well, here he's presenting it as like essentially synonymous. Anyway, the idea is ecstasy and the attraction, the attachment. This ecstasy is developing on the basis of a sakti, which definitely means attachment. So it's the ecstasy, a developing of ecstasy in attachment. So bhava, what is bhava? The immature stage of the Swarup Shakti, or internal energy of the Lord. Let's see. It's described, Rupa Goswami describes it as the first rays of the sun of prema. So it is actually prema, but it's a little bit of prema, pure love of God. So bhava means the level of perfection, but not unqualified, unlimited perfection, just the beginnings of perfection. It's described here as being the budding stage. You remember our example, the example given by Lord Chaitanya of the Kripa, the Bhakti Lata, starting with the seed of Shraddha and growing and growing. So asakti was the bud.
when the bud buds and becomes a flower, that's bhava. And then when the flower becomes a fruit, that's prema, the fruit of love of God. So it is thus the blossoming flower of the desire creeper of bhakti. Its outer luster is the quality of sudurlabha, it's very rarely achieved. And its inner luster is moksha lagukriti, it derives even the conception of liberation. Just one atom of bhava uproots ignorance completely. Where can we get one atom of it? We need it, I need it. Just one atom of it. What to speak of a real dose. And moreover, the profuse release of fragrances of the flower of bhava invites Krishna and causes him to appear there. So, inherent in the understanding of what is the level of bhava is that the devotee is established or is becoming established in his or her direct relationship with Krishna in whichever rasa it may be. This is like the fundamental or foundation understanding of what the level of bhava entails. Bhava means ecstasy. And there are different ecstasies. There are different ecstasies which all together, when they're there, means that the person's on the level of bhava, on the level of ecstasy. First is staiva. Staiva. Maybe you should write this down for our test tomorrow. You all know about that, right? So, who knows what a staiva is? Who knows how many staivas there are? Come on. Some of you took our Nectar of Devotion course. Don't tell me you've got on me. You're not on me. Okay, so there are five staivas, beginning with shanta. In other words, the five rasas. Yeah. These are the five stai bhavas. And when we talk about the level of bhava, we talk of being in a state which is fundamentally characterized by your particular bhava. Your particular stai bhava. Depending on which one you're in. You may be in a mutual relationship. This is already there within your heart. Yes, your swaroops. Of course. What particular relationship you have with Krishna. You may be in Shantaras, Dasyaras, Sakyaras, Vatsalyaras, or Madhuryaras, whatever it is. It's already there. But the level of bhava means that it is becoming manifest, and it's the basic element on the level of bhava. And it is enhanced by other bhavas, say other ecstasies. And we'll tell you what those are in a few minutes. So what more can I say? Well, I could also say the same thing. And that could be the end of the course. But we'll carry on. Centered by the fragrances of bhava. Anyway, he's making this point. What more can I say? Because this is so transcendental that, you know, we are just sort of flailing around on the edge, and we may get a little idea that we're actually talking about something which is a little beyond us, well beyond us. So all of the emotions of the heart become like the oil of liquefied bunches of sesame seeds, at once fit to smear on all the limbs of the Lord. Just at the appearance of bhava, even a chandala becomes worthy of respect from Lord Brahma and others. And then there's a description in the next paragraph of, you could say, like the emotional state. Yeah, it's very interesting. It's a little hard to distinguish between it and the state of the person on the level of asakti, other than to say it's just a much more intense. But it says here, when asakti reaches extreme maturity, so it's just like a very extreme condition that devotee on the level of asakti is in, looking for Krishna and wondering where Krishna is and like that. So at that time his eyes fully long to turn towards Vrajendranandan, to lick the blackness of his limbs. the rosy hue of his lips and eye rings, the white brilliance of his moon-like teeth shining in his smiling face, and the yellow hue of his clothing and ornaments. They then begin to bathe his body in profuse streams of tears. There's a little grammatical error there. Like he is running here. So he is running here and there. He's running here and there sometimes. Sometimes he's freezing his motion and raising his ears. Not very well expressed there. He longs for his ears to be decorated with the earrings of the song of Krishna's flute, the jingling of his anklets, and the sweet intonation of his voice. So, yes, his nostrils open wide, repeatedly and inhale, anxious to examine the fragrance of the Lord's body, because he was already beginning to perceive the Lord in Sakti, and now he's actually doing that, and he's actually more or less situated, coming to be situated in his eternal rasa with Krishna. So this is very, very, very profound and most astonishing level of consciousness. Then going down that paragraph, down to about the sixth line from the bottom of the paragraph. Having obtained the most precious jewel of Bhava, the devotee tries to hide it like a miser from the ordinary people. However, the famous logic says that a bright face reveals hidden wealth. The face is the index of the mind. Thus, advanced devotees will recognize the status of this devotee as he becomes a residence of all wonderful qualities. Of course, common people, being unable to understand all this, will conclude that he's mad. So then we'll just skip the next couple of paragraphs. They're talking about Bhava arriving from Vaidhi Sadhana and Bhava arriving from Raghunuda Sadhana. We won't bother going into that subject at this point. But now, right at the bottom, don't turn the page. Well, we will in a second, but right at the bottom of page 22, last couple of lines. So then again, these five Bhavas, Shantadasya, Sakyavatsalya, Madhurya, depending which one it takes, obtain other Bhavas, other ecstasies, and then they become the kings known as Stai Bhavas. So in other words, that Stai Bhava is the king of the various Bhavas, the various types of ecstasies that the devotee is experiencing on the level of Bhava. So these other Bhavas, they're listed there. You're still on page 22. I hear all these pages shuffling around. But we're still on page 22. So there's Vibhava. There's Anubhava. You can see them all there. There's, what is it now? Satvika. There's Satvika. Satvika. And Vyabhichari. So the underlying ecstasy, which all the other ecstasies are interacting with, and actually when they interact, the idea is that as they interact, they produce something which is called rasa. Anyway, that is now, we're now going on to the level of prana. We haven't finished this. So let's not worry about rasa too much. Now, so Vibhav, what does Vibhav mean? Well, anyway, I'm sure you won't know it, but do you remember Vibhav? Any of our other... Huh? Oh, well done. Okay. It's that which stimulates ecstasy. Well done, Deepak. So what stimulates ecstasy or Bhava? What do you think? Come on, tell me, what do you think? What stimulates ecstasy? Suggest Krishna. Right. Krishna. So the devotee sees Krishna, thinks of Krishna, hears Krishna's name. And this is Vibhava. And not only Krishna, what else What else stimulates ecstasy?
Things
associated with it, particularly the devotees. So, vibhav means that which stimulates ecstasy. And anubhav means the response, basically the response. Like, to give you an example, Mother Yashoda sees Krishna, her little baby, and she thinks, oh, Krishna, something like that. So, you know, there's a very deep impact that, oh, here's my baby Krishna. So this is vibhava. Then anubhava means she then picks him up and embraces him. The response to this, the stimulation. Get the idea? Then sattvikabhav means, what would you say? Well, it basically means the emotion. So she embraces Krishna, and what does she do? She cries. There's a very nice example given in Nectar of Devotion to illustrate like the succession of these bhavas one after the other. The example is of Maharaj Ambarish, when Devasamuni was trying to harass him. He created some demon to kill Maharaj Ambarish. So Maharaj Ambarish saw, here's this demon. And then what did he think? Of course he's a pure, he's on the level of Bhava. He thought, Krishna. So that's vibhava. Then he thought, I better take shelter. So he took shelter of Krishna within his mind. He remembered Krishna, prayed to Krishna. So that's anubhava. And then as he was doing that, tears came to his eyes. So that's sattvikabhava. So sattvikabhava and vyabhicharibhava are related. Sattvikabhava, there are 8 sattvikabhavas, which you also have to know all of these for the test tonight. And everything else. Like in Tattva Sandhara, you have to learn all the Sanskrit.
Don't worry about the English.
So there are 8 sattvikabhavas. A devotee may become stunned, fall on the ground, hairs may stand on end, faltering voice, trembling, tears, perspiration, change of bodily colour, and devastation. These are the 8 sattvikabhavas. Any of you who have read Chaitanya Charitamrita, you've read the chapter, I think it's Madhya Lila, chapter 13, Lord Chaitanya dancing at Ratha Yatra. So there's a vivid description of how he's manifesting these sattvikabhava. His hairs are sticking out like porcupines, quills, tears squirting from his eyes, his body sometimes golden, which is the normal color, then turning white, then turning pink, and all things like this, and then fainting on the ground, crashing on the ground. So these are sattvikabhavas. They're very intense. They're not permanent, but they're not so temporary as vyabhicharibhavas. These are called transient. In other words, more temporary emotional conditions. More transient types of emotional conditions. There are 33 of them, and you just have to learn all of them. If I had Nectar of Devotion, I could read them out to you, but things like a feeling of pride comes up, and then it goes, and a feeling of humility comes. So these more transient emotional conditions, they're called vyabhicharibhavas. And as they mix, they're called sanchari. As the sattvika and the avichari herbs mix, they're called sanchari. But anyway, generally we talk of five bhavas, but this sanchari is sort of like a condition of the mixing. Anyway, I don't know if you'll have to worry too much about these things for a while. Of course, I hope you do. This is very high level of Krishna consciousness. This is really very high. So basically, the devotee is experiencing these different ecstasies. Being totally absorbed in Krishna consciousness to the absolute exclusion of anything else. However, having said all that, there are nine anubhavs, there are many anubhavs, there are nine particular anubhavs or responses to the stimulation of Krishna or Krishna's devotees, the stimulations of Krishna consciousness. There are five observable symptoms. Like we read, he said there that, like a miser, the devotee tries to hide this treasure of Baba. So like you take Srila Prabhupada, he was certainly on the level of Baba, on the level of Prema. But he was hiding these emotional conditions almost completely. So we talked about this yesterday. He was generally like an extremely together, level-headed, intelligent, organized gentleman of the first degree. So, he was hiding his emotional symptoms generally. Not always, but generally. Now, there are nine symptoms of bhava, which are only really possible on the level of bhava, at least in really significant states, but they're unhideable and they're easily observable. And these are concern about time, meaning not to waste a second from being engaged in Krishna's service. This is first. Then, being absolutely perseverant. Perseverant, is it? Probably. Anyway. Being totally detached. If you want details on all this, this is all described elaborately in chapter 18 of Nectar of Devotion. In fact, the entire chapter is simply on this subject. These observable and unhideable symptoms of bhava. Prideless. A state of total humility. Bhava, incidentally, is the level of Uttama Adhikari. Prabhupada mentions this in Nectar of Devotion. And great hope. If we had a Nectar of Devotion, I could read some of the things which are said there. A great eagerness to engage in Krishna conscious activities. Attachment to chanting, eagerness to engage in devotional activities, and then another eagerness, distinguished from number six, eagerness to glorify the Lord, talk about His glories. And nine, attraction to the places of the Lord. Attraction to the Dharms, the holy Dharms, attachment to the temple where the deity is, because that's also the abode of the Lord, the place of the Lord. So this concern about time, what we're talking about is something, if you consider the example of Srila Prabhupada, that he would take rest tonight about 11, and he'd be up at 1. And he'd be chanting for a couple of hours, then he'd be translating. Then he'd go on his morning walk, greet the deities, then he'd be dealing with the devotees and the whole international movement. Then he'd take lunch, then he'd have a little rest for an hour, usually around 2 or 3 take rest for an hour. Then he'd be up again and it would be darshan, meeting with devotees, guests, whoever was around. And then into the evening, meeting, dealing with the movement again, and like this. Or Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I'm sure you've heard about his example, says this type of concern about time, that things like eating and sleeping become insignificant. Like Haridas Thakur chanting 22 and a half hours a day, Raghunath Das Goswami also 22 and a half hours a day in devotional service, oftentimes forgetting to eat and sleep, having to be reminded after 3 days that you haven't eaten or slept for 3 days. You should, otherwise it's not good for your body. Like that. So this sort of concern for time. I don't think we've got time to go into them all, because we've got to talk about prema. So just take it. I mean, they're very, very nice examples of all of these. But please just take it that they are there. And these are very important symptoms. They come under the heading of anubhavs. These are actually anubhavs, because it means they're responses. You're responding to Krishna. So they're actually considered anubhavs. And they're actually considered the most important anubhavs, because they're basically unhideable. They're basically unhideable. Whereas the very emotional conditions, they can be hidden. They generally can be hidden. So, all right, now, prema.
One person.
Yeah.
The devotee is experiencing these conditions in the heart.
Yeah.
So that means it is internal consciousness. It's no more external awareness of external reality. Lost.
But reduced considerably.
So how does he have this control over hiding these emotions?
So if he's ordered by his spiritual master to be a preacher, then this is a vibhav, because vibhav means that which stimulates. So the order of the spiritual master definitely is a stimulant in Krishna consciousness. It's the main stimulant. So that it arouses the response of acting in a certain way. So on that basis, by the arrangement of the Lord, is able to control himself generally. Yeah. Okay. So right at the end here now, we're on page 23. Right at the bottom of the second paragraph. When bhava first matures and begins to transform into prema, that very Vrajendra Nanda, who is the personification of rasa, is directly realized by qualified devotees. So then the first paragraph to do with prema, it's basically explaining about how this is all coming, that the flowers are coming to fruit. Then one of the characteristics of prema, although it would sound like perhaps it's a characteristic even of a satyabhava, but a characteristic of prema is that one totally loses any identification with anything other than Krishna. So let us just read the third paragraph. The nectar which comes from the fruit of prema has the essential quality of concentrated bliss, and its outstanding nourishing property is its power to attract Krishna. When the devotee begins to taste that nectar, he does not take heed of any obstacles. Like a miser feverish for treasure, like a thief who has lost all sense of discretion out of absorption in his job of stealing, the devotee loses all sense of self-consciousness. Sometimes there's an impatience for obtaining a Lord, like a hunger that cannot be satisfied, even by eating the most tasty foods day and night. The devotee burns like the sun through that anxiety. He's soothed only by tasting the form, qualities, and sweetness of the Lord, which make momentary